Before we dive in today, I want to let you know a few ways you can support the podcast. The biggest one by far is word of mouth. If you enjoy this and you know other Stephen King fans, please tell them about it. Share the episodes on social media. It really does help. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. And if you are really dedicated to the show, you can become a Patreon supporter where I will have bonus episodes going up. I am covering all of the Stephen King related comics over on Patreon. So there's definitely going to be a lot more bonus content coming this year. And now let's get into the episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I am joined once again by Katie from I Hope You Suffer podcast. We're talking all about the TV miniseries Bag of Bones today. Katie, how are you doing?
I am doing great. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. You know, I think this is the last of the Mick Garris adaptations.
That is quite a feat for you.
And I want to say that I think Mick Garris is one of those people who has been very present in the horror scene for quite a while. And even though most of his adaptations have been fine, in my opinion, it's not like I watched his movies or TV miniseries and was like, oh wow, what a waste of time. It wasn't like that at all for me. Instead, it was like, okay, this is sort of like the standard for the TV adaptations that I think is a step above a lot of what I've watched.
Mm-hmm. This one to me, like, aside from some things later in the movie that we'll discuss, this one didn't really seem like, whenever I think Mick Garris, I think something crazy, wacky is happening. Mm-hmm. Because most of the ones that we've covered or most of the ones that I've seen have been just like really wacky synopsis. And this one is actually like pretty down to earth. And not a lot of like, I mean, there are some things obviously, but not a lot of things happen for me to be like, oh yeah, this is definitely like Mick Garris has his hand in this. So it is a little bit different. So to me, I would agree it is kind of a step above a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, I've watched the Langoliers, the Tommyknockers, and so many that I did not particularly care for, that even when I don't necessarily love some of the other adaptations, it's just like, okay, this was good. It was fine. I did not waste my time. It wasn't, you know, 80 episodes of The Dead Zone.
Right. At least I feel like even if it's not the best like adaptation or movie or what have you, at least it's normally like if he's involved, there's some aspect of it that's fun. So Even if it's not the best, at least, yeah, exactly. You're not wasting your time.
Yeah. One thing that's been fairly consistent have been the practical effects in a lot of these Mick Garris adaptations. You have those things to look forward to, which a lot of horror fans love to talk about, makeup and effects. And, you know, Bag of Bones, this came out in 2011 and it was adapting a novel from 1998. So you had quite a stretch of time between this. And I actually was reading my Stephen King at the Movies book and found out that Bruce Willis had optioned this, but he couldn't find someone to sort of take it on. And then Mick Garris came and took over. So this sounds like one of those ones where it was kind of in the works for a while, which happens with more Stephen King adaptations than you would think.
Yeah, I mean, from the outside, it doesn't seem like that. But since we've, you know, we did our like Stephen King month, you know, obviously we're not doing it this year. Just like doing the background research, it is kind of crazy, like the amount of his stuff that just sort of like almost never gets made, like multiple times even for some of the things. And it's just like, sometimes I feel like it gets to the point where someone's like, okay, we might as well just do it. So we say we did it and it's over with and we don't have to talk about it anymore. But I don't know. That is really strange.
Yeah, I think it helps that with this story in particular too, though, it's a very small cast of characters. You have Pierce Brosnan as Mike Noonan. You have Melissa George, Annabeth Gish. And really only a few other characters outside of those three. Sure, people come and go, but you never really feel like this is going to be something like what we get when he's talking more about an entire town. And even though this takes place in a small town, and he could have easily come up with a story where you had 10 to 20 characters that we were seeing more often, he chose to really focus on a smaller set of characters.
And it's also like, for this specifically, we don't really see anything happening to those other characters unless it directly relates to Mike Noonan.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of, like, specifically, we can look at, like, something like Salem's Lot, where there's, like, so much stuff going on, like, behind the scenes and whatnot. And anything, I mean, most of his stories are, like, small town, evil secrets happening, and there's, like, all kinds of things behind the works. And here we're really just dealing with, like, him and how that all relates to him personally, and then, like, him finding out kind of, like, the secrets as he goes along. But we, as the people, like, watching this miniseries, don't know the answers either, which I think is kind of refreshing compared to some of his other stuff.
Yeah, and I obviously have to give a shout out to Matt Frewer, who has been in numerous Stephen King adaptations. They all happen to be Mick Garris ones, so I'm guessing they are friends in some capacity, because he was Trash Can Man in the Stan miniseries. He was in Quicksilver Highway. I don't think he was in The Shining, simply because The Shining is, again, an even smaller story, but in this, he plays Mike's brother, Sid, and he is in both parts, but like you said, only when he has to interact with Mike.
It's something, like, interesting that I didn't really get, like, when I was watching it, I didn't really think about it until you pointed out, like, how little characters there are, because sometimes I feel like, for me, King stuff suffers from too many people and too many subplots. And there is a point. And so I also thought it was strange to call it a miniseries, even though it's like two episodes. And I feel like, I don't know. I don't know if the length worked for me, because there is a point where there is a lot of subplot going on with it, like, all at once. And I almost was like, oh, this is too much stuff happening. But then it does all tie together, like, really neatly. And I'm like, okay, all right, it's fine. But yeah, because it's literally just all him finding out, like, these different pieces. And I actually thought, like, aside from the ending, I thought the story was actually, this is, like, very much more of, like, a down-to-earth sort of story. It's not like, I don't know, everything's normal, and then all of a sudden a demon from space happens or something crazy like that. And that's what I really appreciate this about this story, is that it's just like Mike Noonan sort of like going about his very ordinary life. But then there's just like this other kind of like supernatural stuff going on. And then also there's a mystery that's very human and like very normal. And that's what I like really enjoyed about this.
The runtime is about 2 hours and 40 minutes, I want to say. And it wasn't necessarily that I felt it being that long. It was just one of those things where I was like, okay, is that a good length for this kind of story? And Bag of Bones isn't a small book, but I think with these two or three night events, a lot of the time, they just make it like an extended movie. And I do think that obviously you kind of have to have your cliffhanger when part one ends. But when you're watching it on DVD or streaming or whatever, it's just going to play right through to the next part. So things like that aren't quite as effective when you're just watching it in one sitting. But I do like the fact that they seem to give the creators the amount of time that they want to tell the stories, which you don't necessarily get with feature films all the time. Obviously, there are some people who can, you know, turn it into a two-part movie. And I guess the runtime on those has to be fairly close to 5 hours, right? Aren't they both over 2 hours?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Yeah, I haven't read the book, so I don't really know how I feel like it translates. But I do, I don't know why, I love the idea of like a two-part, like, I'm just going to call it a movie. I know they say miniseries because they aired it, but I just love the idea of like airing, like filming something and then airing it as two different parts on TV, which doesn't happen anymore, obviously, in the same capacity. And I think part of the thing that makes me love things like this and things like Rose Red, which is what we talked about last time, is that kind of like, I don't know, build up behind this like crazy two-part, this story is so crazy, it has to be shown in two parts or whatever. And I don't know why, but it just really works on me.
That's fair. And I love that kind of ghost story too. So this was one that I hadn't heard a ton about the book going into reading all of the books and watching all of these things, because it feels like once you get past a certain point, people talk a little less about, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s King books almost. And I've always found that to be very interesting, because it's like outside of him finishing up The Dark Tower, I don't hear a ton about the books that kind of came before and after those three. And Bag of Bones, I was like, why don't people talk about this story more? Because it's really this ghost story, haunted house kind of story. And I really, really like those. And like you said, kind of similar to Rose Red as well, which obviously does not have source material behind it since it was written for TV.
Yeah, I guess I don't know why his stories of that are my favorite, like you said, are the ghost stories. And I guess, I don't know, maybe people feel like, because especially Rose Red was kind of a different beast because of the story was a little bit wacky just based on what he based the source material on. And I don't know, this story just seems so like, you know, setting aside if you believe in supernatural forces, because a big part of this obviously is him being haunted by multiple ghosts, the story is just so like a thing that just could have happened. You know what I mean? It's also kind of like, I think this one still takes place in Maine, but it had a lot of like, I don't know how to explain it. The kind of influence behind what you find out was actually going on in this town has sort of like Southern roots almost to me, which makes it feel even more grounded than something like Rose Red. So I don't know if people just don't like it because it's not unique enough. You know what I mean? Because like this kind of story sort of has been told before, right? It's like a pretty common, unfortunately, part of things that just happen in the world. But so I don't know, maybe that's why. I definitely read the book, but it was so long ago that I don't really remember anything that happened from it. And then I watched the miniseries probably 3 or 4 years ago for the first time, maybe. So even as someone who loves his kind of more plain stories, it wasn't really big on my radar either, and I'm not really sure why.
Yeah, it's kind of like a lot of people talk about The Stand, The Shining, Carrie, Pet Sematary, It, Salem's Lot even, you know, that's been adapted a couple of times. And then a lot of stuff just kind of gets overlooked. You know, I felt that way about Bag of Bones, Lisey's Story, which is getting an adaptation this year. So there's that to look forward to see how they kind of take that story that I haven't heard as much about. And, you know, since doing this podcast, I've kind of connected with a lot of other Stephen King fans who have read a ton of his stuff. And I'm not going to speak for them and say that any of them have read everything, because I don't know that for a fact. I haven't asked those questions to people, but it seems like there's just a stretch where it's like, yeah, he released books.
Mm-hmm.
But for this, you know, to dive into the story here, you have a tragedy that happens at the very beginning where Mike's wife, Jo, dies. In this, she is hit by a bus while crossing the street at one of his book signings. And you find out then, too, that she was also pregnant. And that kind of doubles the tragedy for Mike. And he decides to take a break from the city because from what I can tell, at least we know the book signing was in New York City, but it does seem like they live there. And then this is sort of a house he inherited that's in Maine. And I think this sort of location might pop up somewhere else, but I am having a big brain fart right now and cannot confirm that. But it's kind of one of those, not necessarily desolate, but just small town wooded areas that has a very specific vibe to it. You know, this is a lake house and he's just kind of running on these trails and he never really runs into anyone. So that kind of tells you how small of a place this is.
Yeah, it really is. Like there's so it's a lake house. Well, first of all, and it's beautiful. It's like on a lake. It's got, you know, the gorgeous like pine trees all around it. And there is a scene where he's driving through and it's like really, you know, what they call like a one horse town. It's like, there's one diner, there's one this, there's one that. And then it's basically just like, he doesn't really run into other people until he starts getting pulled into, you know, like the thing with, is it Maddie?
Maddie, DeVore, and Kira.
Yeah. So that's when he starts getting pulled into sort of like, even though he's technically has roots in this town, it's kind of like all of this stuff that starts happening to him is really literally just because he goes to that house and then other people like pull him into stuff. So, and then, you know, there's a lot of scenes of him like running to terrible music. But even out on the pass, there's like nobody for miles. So it is like maybe the smallest town he's ever written about, I would think.
Yeah. And what I found the most odd about this story is the fact that this big sort of computer company guy, Max DeVore, just lives out in the middle of nowhere. And obviously it's implied that he is basically retired now. And it just felt like an odd place, even for someone who was super rich, to be. And I think that kind of helped make the mystery a little greater in this too, because it's like, why is this rich guy here when there are very clear, when there are definitely, you know, areas where rich people go to retire sort of, and this does not seem like that area.
Yeah, and because it kind of like takes a little bit, it's like really the pacing of this is like a little strange because it's like within 10 minutes, Joe is dead. And within 20 minutes, he is at the cabin and being very lightly haunted. You know, it's like the thing that I did like about the hauntings in this is that it's like pretty normal stuff that I could imagine like as a person going through grief and having suffered like a really big loss, you start to think you could just brush it off as like me just being weird. You know, like he starts having dreams and then he's like thinks that his wife is like calling him on the phone or whatever. But it is such a small town that before you even find out anything that there's like a dark secret, You are kind of just like, why is this guy? He's like obviously super into himself. And like part of you, you know, we come to find out that he quote unquote owns the town, but still at that point, you're like, there's got to be something there that's like physically keeping him in this spot. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what it is until pretty much the very end. So it's a long journey.
Yeah, and what I really enjoyed about this story, though, is how it does unfold. There are some things that were a little more present in the book, like Mike's connection with Kira, because we get that moment where she basically tells him that the two of them had the same dream. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this came across, but it was like she was the one communicating with him with the letters on the fridge in the book, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, okay.
Because at the beginning when it first happens and it says, hello, Mike, it's like hello with one L and Mike with no E. And you know, I watched it with my mom and she was like, well, maybe they just only have one of each letter. And I was like, I don't know, because if you're supposed to make words with
right,
these things,
exactly.
You would think you would have multiples, but I have no idea if that came across to anyone else. Did that come across to you, or was that something where you couldn't tell if it was Kira or Sarah Tidwell?
I thought it was Joe.
Or that option.
Actually, I thought it was Joe because, it did not even cross my mind that it might have been the little girl. I thought it was Joe because in the miniseries, they like, there's a moment where we actually see the magnets move by themselves because he gets like scared by it. And then there's a moment later where he is like, it spells out something, and then he realizes that it's supposed to be like a clue from his writing. And so that points to that, like, basically ends up leading him to the ending that we get. And so I thought it was, at least they made me think that it was Joe. Like, so I don't know if they changed that to kind of like streamline it, because the whole thing with Maddie and Kira, or Kyra, or whatever her name is that I felt their connection, their instant connection, was very strange. Like, the pacing between their relationship is one of the things that I have issues with, because he has a dream. I don't know why his, like, wife dying all of a sudden gives him the power of, like, dream premonitions, but that's what happens, because he's, like, seeing all kinds of stuff. He has a dream where he sees her basically die. So then when he comes across her just like walking down the middle of the road, he's like, oh, hey, and he like saves her. And Maddie is like, oh my gosh, you're my favorite author, thanks. And then he gets like sucked into this custody battle where you really only see them like after that together. They're like at the custody hearing, then they have the kind of like, they talk about his wife, and Maddie's like, oh yeah, I saw her at the diner with somebody else, because there's this whole, you know, like subplot of Mike thinking that maybe his wife has cheated on him, which was just a terrible thing to have to be dealing with when she's just passed. So that added like another layer of just like, I could just tell how much this like character was hurting. But, and then it goes from that to her calling and being like, hey, come over to my house, and he immediately kisses her when he gets there, and then is like having that conversation with the little girl where she's like, yeah, I had the same dream because I know what's going on. And so that was like really strange to me, because there's not a lot of emotional investment that we see between the characters. So that was something I was wondering about, if it was like more explained in the book, because I feel like they just went from like 1 to 100 with the relationship.
Right. I'll break down some of the bigger differences for you from the book without hopefully spoiling too much in case you want to go read the book later. But in the beginning, when we get Joe's death, she is not hit by a bus in the book. She dies a different way in the book, but it still has the same effect because she was pregnant and the death was unexpected. So they changed the manner of death, but it still had the same effect, which I think that's fine. You know, the point is that she died, she was pregnant, and Mike goes to the lake house.
Mm-hmm.
And then, aside from Kira and Maddie being slightly different ages in the book, Kira's only 3 in the book, whereas she's like 6 here, I think. But her and Mike have a psychic connection, and that is explored a lot more. And I think in the book it works because King can take that time to describe those things. But if we kept getting these psychic connections over and over again in the miniseries, it might not have worked quite as well, because it would have felt more repetitive than it does in a book.
Mm-hmm.
There were actually a couple more characters in the book that kind of appear in a different way. Like in the book, Mike does get involved in the custody battle, but he's the one who hires a lawyer for Maddie.
Okay.
And there's a private detective as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I sort of feel like, I know I'm complaining about the fact that their relationship just seemed to take off. But then at the same time, if they spent too much time on it, maybe I would have been like, all right, can we do other stuff? Because like the bulk of this is just like him experiencing like paranormal stuff and trying to piece together like what's going on, what his wife was doing. But I don't know. I just felt like that was strange as far as like the pacing of the miniseries goes.
Yeah, and we go through all of these weird things happening in Mike's life. He's clearly getting attached to Kira and Maddie as well, which even though she's like half his age.
Yeah.
In the book, the lawyer and private detective are there when the shooting happens. And in the book, it's a drive-by shooting. They don't go in the house. And again, slightly different, but same outcome.
Mm-hmm.
No matter which one you're reading or watching. And I did like the fact that they gave us these kind of flashbacks to 1939 to fill some of the time, because if they had left us in the present day without having those sort of flashbacks to show us who Sarah Tidwell was, it wouldn't have worked quite as well. You know, if he had just found Joe's research and then started diving into that, it would have felt like something was missing. So I like that they did include those flashbacks, but they were still kind of weird.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I feel like it is, like, reflecting on it, I definitely feel like they needed to be in there, at least in some capacity. I think the thing that was weird to me about it was, like, not necessarily the first one where I think he falls asleep, like we know he's sleeping, and he like is at the state fair and he's seeing her sing. But then when it happens again later and he like encounters Kyra in the dream, but then also Sarah and her daughter, that scene to me was weird. Because at that point, we don't know that he has a connection with Kyra. So that's why I'm like, when I was watching it, I was like, why can he interact with her and like run around and people grab her? And like that specific scene to me of the past, I thought was really strange in context to like the other stuff.
It definitely would have benefited from setting up that psychic connection a little more, because they only mention it in passing when she's like, oh, I had the same dream as you. And then you're kind of like, okay, so there's some sort of thing going on with the two of them here. But yeah, it's definitely more fleshed out in the book. And the ending is also different, but I don't want to give the ending away for you or anyone who hasn't read the book. But it is left open-ended still, either way. So I think that's okay too. And story-wise, this is one of King's stories that I think really takes a good look at a single character and what he is going through and sort of how he is able to not necessarily completely get over that trauma, but the steps he is taking to get that closure is just so unique. And obviously, King has written plenty of stories about writers, and Mike is a best-selling author, but I think this one just takes a different look at his life because of this terrible tragedy that happens right at the beginning. And one thing King is very good at is writing characters who have these multiple traumas happening, to where by the end of the story, you realize, oh yeah, this big thing happened all the way at the beginning, but then this other traumatic event happened that kind of makes you forget about that first one for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. First off, I love when he writes stories about writers or just when any writer is writing about a writer. I love it. I don't know why, but it is like really interesting because like you said, there is that big trauma, which is probably like the biggest trauma you could if someone in his position could face, because you know the first like 10 minutes of the movie really kind of like set up their relationship and how he really relies on Joe to be able to write, and that's the reason he's like a best-selling author or whatever. And then just like in the blink of an eye, that's gone. So not only is he dealing with like the loss of his wife, the loss of his like unborn child, he finds out, he's dealing with like the loss of feeling like he can't write anymore because the one thing he needed was her and she's gone. So it's like, where does he go from there if he can't write? Also, his agent is like, by the way, I need another book in 3 months or something like that. So he's got to deal with that. Then he thinks his wife is cheating on him. And it's just like such a, you know, and then we do get those few days where he's just like, the house is trashed. He's just like calling her phone and listening to her voicemail, which was a really weird voicemail, by the way. But it's just like, they did such a good job of setting up that you actually can like, you feel bad for this character, which I feel like in a lot of the miniseries or, things like that, I feel like a lot of times that sort of emotion is missing for me, and it's not in this one. So it's like, that would be enough for the whole movie, technically. But then they're like, oh yeah, then you have to like deal with all this other stuff. Also, you're being haunted, so it's like, he's just like being a normal person, and then he's getting like the crap scared out of him randomly, and then immediately has to like talk to the housekeeper, like his entire kitchen, and just get thrown around by a poltergeist or something. And it's just like, he's just like, I don't know. It just is like exhausting for him, but it's kind of like, he can't stop. Like he cannot put a hold on his life. You know, he has to just keep going. And then I don't know. It just feels like he's like trying his best to be a good person and he just can't win, which sometimes I feel like King writes a lot of about, but then a lot of times it is like bad things happen and people remain shitty I feel like we don't really often get a character of his who's just like a totally normal guy who like hasn't done anything wrong. You know what I mean? It's like the stuff is just happening to him and you have no reason to dislike him because he's just like trying to do the most. And so I feel like that to me makes this exactly like you were saying. It's a look at the characters that he writes a lot, but like a really unique perspective.
Yeah. He's also so good at writing characters that you just instantly hate. And Max and his assistant are those characters. And the scene where, you know, she's throwing rocks at Mike after pushing him into the lake, that is pretty accurate to the book. And it was just one of those scenes that shows you how heartless these people are, because we already know that the little girl is basically a pseudo daughter for Mike almost instantly. And he's just trying to do the right thing. But this greedy old white man, of course, can't let that happen.
No. And it's like even worse because, you know, we find out that the Max is the little girl's grandfather and he's like calling her a harlot and like all of these like things and like, you know, trying to pay Mike off to literally just like leave, and is alluding to the fact that he will quote unquote do whatever it takes. And it's just like the root, it's just like the most evil. If you can think of like the most evil thing, it's this guy. And especially the way he looks, and then his like assistant lady, just they're quite the pair. They just like look like evil incarnate. I don't know what else to say about them.
They really do. It's quite uncanny how they made those characters look so evil.
They really are like caricatures, but it doesn't, it still like fits in with, I mean, I can't really say enough how just like pretty normal. It's not like Derry, where we know inherently there's some kind of evil lurking here and there and people are possessed or this, that, the other thing or whatever. It's just like completely grounded in the real world story. And then you just have these like completely evil people that they just like look like vultures. They really do.
Right. And the whole reason he's staying there, and we come to find that Maddie shot Lance because he was trying to drown their daughter, and you get all of this backstory, but it unfolds piece by piece. It's not like a ton of exposition all at once to give you the full story as to what is really happening. And then we finally get that flashback where you have Sarah Tidwell being brutally attacked. Her and her daughter are killed. I believe it's a son in the book, but again, doesn't really matter. You know, they kill her child either way. And you find out that one of Mike's ancestors were there. And so basically it's like fathers and grandparents of a bunch of people in town who were involved in this, and they've all been cursed to kill their own child or grandchild. And it's kind of crazy how the whole thing comes together, because you see these flashbacks with some of these men in them, but you never know who they are until that moment. And I like that they didn't instantly point out, oh, that's so-and-so and that's so-and-so.
Right. I was thinking about that when I was talking about the times that we see Mike in the flashbacks, because it's like the very first time you do see the whole scene of the crowd that they later show. And you're just like, okay, it's just a group, you know, it's just like a bunch of people from the town. And then it's like, no, like that was my grandfather. That was Max. That was this guy. That was that guy. And you're like, oh, wow. We knew that, like, we saw this the entire time. And that's what I think I like about this so much, is that they tie up, because we also find out that Sarah goes missing and no one ever knows what happens to her. Then we also have this other random thing about the this tree who looks like a curvy lady, which was kind of strange to me. But it's like you have that. You have the, I think they call it the dark score, like, curse.
Dark score crazy,
right. You have imagery in the opening even of like children being drowned, and then we have this all this children being drowned, and then you have like Duveau, and you're like I said, at one point I was like, oh my god, there's, and then, you know, he's also being, I don't want to say haunted, he is being haunted by his wife too, and you're just like, there is just so much stuff going on. Like, how are they possibly going to wrap this up? And then all of a sudden we get the scene where Sarah curses them, and then it just like all wraps up in like a tiny little bow. And I was like, how? This is actually kind of impressive.
Yeah.
Because I'm used to his stories
not being wrapped up in a bow.
Right. Not being wrapped up, or the adaptation changed so much of the information that it's kind of like, okay, well, what about this? What about that? So that to me is why this one, even though it's like, I mean, no, it's not the greatest thing I've ever seen, but that's why this story to me is like, just kind of stand apart. I am definitely going to go back and read the book though, because the, after we figure out this whole thing and it all comes together, and, you know, we find out that Joe was like researching and trying to figure out what was happening, and that's why she wanted him to go to the cabin. Everything after that, I don't super care for, honestly, but the rest of it just has so much good stuff that I'm willing to still really like this.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say the book goes a little deeper on a lot of these aspects that you've enjoyed about the miniseries. And again, a lot of the changes I pointed out don't change the outcomes, really. Like, it does not matter if Sarah Tidwell's child was a boy or a girl. It does not matter how Joe died, necessarily. It just matters that they got the same facts right. Like, she was pregnant. She didn't tell him. She was doing something out here at the lake house that he didn't know about, and he has to go investigate it. And I think it's okay for adaptations to change certain elements from the book, but I like that this one stuck with the overall plot and didn't change that part of it.
Yeah, that's good to hear then. So I think I'll definitely enjoy it.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, I don't have too much more to say about this adaptation. Again, it's not, you know, like a 5-star watch or anything like that. I gave it a 3 out of 5, which, that's pretty good. I've watched a lot worse.
Yeah, especially like as far as miniseries go, I feel like it is hard to do it right. But I think this was only my second time watching it. I think I would personally watch it again. I think a 3 out of 5 is pretty fair.
I think this is one you can kind of put on in the background and watch it more than once, just because it's not a story that is super involved. Like, I noticed all of the little references here and there, like when Joe made the comment about, oh, here's your Annie Wilkes, or have fun with your Annie Wilkes or something, you know, that got a chuckle out of me. And they made a reference to Bachman as well, if I'm not mistaken. So you have all of these little references here and there. And like I said, Matt Frewer obviously has been in a bunch of other things. And, you know, it's just fun to see how King sort of connects these things and how the adaptations throw in a little extra, because I don't know if all of these references were necessarily in the book, but you have the fact that you do tend to get a bunch of connections in King books. And I like when that translates to the screen adaptations as well.
I wrote down the Bachman part too, because I think it part of the thing that makes it feel grounded, like not in another dimension, like some of his other stuff seems, is that the reason that his publicist like needs him to pump out another book is because he also mentioned like Grissom and Patterson are coming out with new books, and so is Bachman. And I was like, haha. So I don't know. It's just like fun for me to imagine this character being like a real guy, like in a world where he knows, where like authors are real people that we know them, sort of thing.
Yeah. And there were other connections, like he spoke with Ralph Roberts, who is the main character in Insomnia. You have a mention of Booyah Moon, which is from Lisi's story. So it's just fun to see how these things come about, because even if they're just mentioned in passing, you know, it's a nice nod to the people who have read a bunch of the books or seen a bunch of the other adaptations.
Yeah, that is really fun, because I feel like this miniseries is something that you can just, like, there are some things that are like kind of quintessential King about them, but it is also, I don't know, I feel like somebody who could not know anything about Stephen King, stumble across it, watch it, still enjoy some parts of it. But then it's like, yeah, if you're somebody who's like really more familiar with his universe, it's just kind of like fun stuff for you.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Bag of Bones. I have many more episodes to come, so I am sure we will talk again, either for this podcast or Welcome to Geekdom or I Hope You Suffer, one of the three.
For sure. It was super fun as always.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.